Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, the Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler, Jeff Wolf behind the console this morning, and we are very glad that you have joined us. So what is in the news this morning? Well, if you went to CNN, checked out the 5 o'clock hour, the lower third, the Chiron, growing frustration over confusing CDC messaging. Well, that's not exactly news. That's been the story for the last almost year now since the Biden administration has taken over. So nothing new really on the front there from CNN, but we will get something interesting this morning from Dr. Bob Lahida. He will join us. There is yet a new variant of the virus. You will be hearing about it. How severe might it get? Well, we'll have Dr. Lahida put it in perspective for us. He's been great to join us over the past year and a half or so of the COVID pandemic, and he always manages to cut through to the spin and the hype and give us the reality check on what's going on the medical front. So we'll talk to Dr. Bob Lahida coming up within this half hour, actually. We'll talk with Bob. And also we'll get his recommendations for parents a little bit later on in the program. A lot of talk about schools. Should the kids be in school? Big fight in Chicago with the teachers union this week. We're going to talk with John Gizzi about the big January 6th speech by the president and also the speech of the vice president. Interesting phone calls from Oprah Winfrey and Michelle Obama. Who were they calling this week? Joe Manchin. That's right. Let's put some heat on Joe Manchin. They're putting the heat on for the voting rights bill. It's my understanding from my sources within the Democratic operatives that the next calls that Joe Manchin will be getting will be from the Pope and from Elvis Presley to put pressure on for Build Back Better and also the voting rights legislation. So we'll keep you posted on that. Cheryl Atkinson's going to join us. She's got some very interesting questions about January 6th of 2021, the investigation, and what questions are not being answered and not even being asked by the committee. Interesting conversation we'll have with Cheryl Atkinson because she's got a great blog post at CherylAtkinson.com. And we're going to be talking with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer this morning. Again, unanswered questions about January 6th, his perspective. And also we'll get the very latest on Kazakhstan, the interdiction by Russia, what's next in Ukraine. And we're going to be talking with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer about that. So lots going on. I want to start, though, with the messaging out of the administration this week about January 6th. And rather than attempt to unite the nation, why don't we go ahead, let's exaggerate, and let's further divide our country, which couldn't be much further divided, but let's go ahead and divide it a little more. Morning started off with these speeches from Vice President Harris and President Biden. And here's Vice President Harris, a slight exaggeration here.
Fellow Americans, good morning. Certain dates echo throughout history, including dates that instantly remind all who have lived through them where they were and what they were doing when our democracy came under assault. Dates that occupy not only a place on our calendars, but a place in our collective memory. December 7th, 1941, September 11th, 2001, and January 6th, 2021.
I'm not sure how that one fits in into that three. I'm not sure how January 6th equates to December 7th or 9/11, but she seems to feel that way. Steve Scalise, of course, over on the other side of the aisle, he didn't see it her way.
Try to compare it to the thousands who died on Pearl Harbor on September 11th. You know, it just is very clear they want this to be a politicized day.
And some questions were asked of Jen Psaki at the White House, and she does the typical tap dance.
Instead of focusing on or analyzing comparisons of moments in history, I would suggest that they be a part of solving the threat to democracy that occurs today.
So that's just a sample of the vice president's remarks. Now we can get into what President Biden had to say we would have hoped maybe some sense of unity, maybe some tone. Oh, no, 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 no. President Biden, he kind of unleashed it, and we're going to get into that after we take a check of the traffic and weather. Al Bedia is with us this morning.
In Prince George's County on Route 50, between the Beltway and Annapolis and the Bay Bridge, eastbound and westbound lanes are clear. At the Bay Bridge, two lanes are going east and three lanes are coming west. In Montgomery County on 270, no delays between the Beltway and Frederick, both on the northbound side and on the southbound side. On 66, you're not going to find any delays eastbound or westbound. No construction and no crashes to slow you down. And if you go into the airports, BWI National or Dulles this morning, the roads leading to the terminals are clear of any delays. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Sunny skies and cold temperatures expected on this Saturday. Highs should reach the lower 30s across the region, but with the full sunshine, we will still expect a bit of melt. As we head overnight, partly cloudy, lows back in the 20s in the suburbs, lower 30s around town. For your Sunday, an area of low pressure and a cold front will move into the region, bringing with it some precipitation. Ahead of it, with the cold air, we will have the chance for some freezing rain. In fact, a winter weather advisory is in effect from 6 o'clock in the morning through noon, areas north and west of D.C. We will see temperatures moderate through the afternoon into the low and mid-40s, while periods of rain continue through Sunday evening. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
It is a very crisp 21 degrees in the nation's capital. We're at 6:15 on the Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
We continue with probably the top story of the week. I'm not going to play too much of President Biden because I'm sure you've heard it by now. But if you didn't hear his remarks, we got about 30 seconds or so just to give you a sense of the tone that the president struck. Remember the president that was going to unite the country, the moderate, the guy that could kind of get along with everybody, both sides of the aisle? Well, this was his message on January 6th of this year.
For the first time in our history, a president had not just lost an election, he tried to prevent the peaceful transfer of power as a violent mob breached the Capitol. The former president of the United States of America has created and spread a web of lies about the 2020 election because his bruised ego matters more to him than our democracy or our Constitution.
We all saw.
So that's President Biden, just a sense of the tone of what he struck on January 6th of this year. He was asked, as he was leaving, he was asked about remarks he had made and you know, whether they were divisive. And here's how he responded.
Look, I think we just have to face the facts of what happens. Draw a clear picture for the American people. It's not about me. It's not about the vice president. It really isn't. That's the thing that bothers me most about the sort of attitude that seems to be emerging to some degree in American politics. It's not about you. It's about me. That's how it's viewed. But it's not about me. It's not about whether I'm president or she's vice president. It's about the system and about somebody who decides to put himself above everything. But I did not want to turn it into a contemporary political battle between me and the president. It's way beyond that. It's way beyond that.
But does calling him out divide more than it heals, sir? Does calling him out divide more than it heals? You've talked so much about healing, sir, healing this country.
No, look, the way you have to heal, you have to recognize the extent of the wound. You can't pretend. This is serious stuff. And a lot of people, understandably, want to go, look, that was an exception. I just assume not face it. You got to face it. That's what great nations do. They face the truth, deal with it, and move on.
Did you get that? Deal with it and move on. Move on. It took him a minute and 23 seconds to say, deal with it and move on. Have you seen any semblance of the notion that Democrats are going to move on from January 6th. It's a year ago. They reinvigorated it. They rejuvenated it. They brought it back. And now they're going to present it from Capitol Hill in the committee hearings, which they will drag out, as you know, at least through the November elections. They'll try and drag it out all the way to 2024 because they're still paranoid that Trump could run and also paranoid that Trump could win. So nice try on that one, Joe. Another one of your misrepresentations, to be polite. Move on. You guys have not moved on. You are not moving on, and you will not move on, because if you moved on, you'd have to talk about things that you're doing for the country as opposed to things that you're doing to the country. They have not much to talk about in terms of accomplishment. So what's the narrative? Go after Trump. Why not? So that's just some sense of what's going on. Now, you've heard this whole notion that Trump perpetuates the big lie, and Hillary Clinton lost, as you may recall, in 2016. But as late as September of 2019, here's Hillary Clinton talking about her big lie.
I believe he knows he's an illegitimate president. He knows. He knows that there were a bunch of different reasons why the election turned out the way it did.
All right, so Hillary Clinton calling President Trump an illegitimate president. That's her big lie, and she continues to perpetuate that one. And we can't forget Jerry Nadler. We'll just give him 10 seconds or so as he criticizes the illegitimate President Trump.
The Russian weighing in on the election, the Russian attempt to hack the election, and frankly, the FBI's weighing in on the election, I think makes his election illegitimate.
Okay, so the Democrats perpetuated that one for 4 years of the Trump administration. Oof, hypocrisy. Oh, speaking of hypocrisy, this is a gem. You may know that Ron Klain is the chief of staff at the White House. You would think Ron Klain might be responsible for the testing problems that we're having, the fact that we can't get the test swabs, and that they had an opportunity in October to order, 500 million of them, and they opted not to. The Biden administration turned down the opportunity to order test kits back in October. Now, I want to take you back to June 26th of 2020. This is smack dab in the middle of the pandemic and the Trump administration. This is Ron Klain on Twitter. Now, keep in mind, this is the guy who is in charge at the White House, a White House that doesn't have test swabs available because they didn't order them, right? So here's what he said about the Trump administration. Quote, testing still isn't fixed. Now, these are his words. He repeats this like 16 times here, okay? So I'm just repeating it verbatim from his Twitter. Testing still isn't fixed. Testing still isn't fixed. Testing still isn't fixed. We are the richest country on earth, and we don't have enough swabs. Testing still isn't fixed. Testing still isn't fixed. End of quote. Well, Ron, nice job. Talk about hypocrisy. Now, we've all seen Vice President Harris attempting to do something for her image. She continues to tank in the polls. All the communications people are basically leaving her office and they're bringing new ones in. But she still can't stop the laugh. She can't stop the cackling. Here she is with Judy Woodruff, okay? I mean, Judy Woodruff of PBS asking Vice President Harris this week about the year.
This year, Madam Vice President, has not been an easy one for you. There have been a rash of stories about dissension inside your office, inside the White House, about questions about your role. What would you say you've learned over this year?
Well, one of the things I've learned is to get out of D.C.
Well, that's not a bad idea, actually. That's a look at some of the messaging out of the administration this week. We're at 6:24. We're going to check in with Dr. Bob Lahida next. Actually, we're going to present him twice this morning. We've got a segment we're going to run next, and then we'll run another segment with Dr. Bob Lahida coming up in the 7 o'clock hour. A lot of interesting information on the latest variant, and also on immunity. He's authored a book on immunity, and it's a big bestseller at Amazon. So interesting comments coming up from Dr. Bob Lahida. Stay with us right here on the Saturday Morning Update. It's the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler, and with all of the confusion that we have seen in and around the coronavirus, the Omicron variant, media reports, reports out of the White House, a lot of confusion, and we always turn to somebody that can really help. It's Dr. Bob Lahida, and he is the director of the St. Joseph Institute for Autoimmune and Rheumatic Disease. He is also a professor of medicine at the Hackensack Meridian School of Medicine, and he has just authored the book, Immunity Strong, Boost Your Natural Healing Power and Live to 100. Dr. Lahida, thanks for coming back with us.
Thanks, Rick. It's a pleasure to be with you.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the Omicron variant. And now there is a new mutation also being discussed.
Yeah, this is a variant that comes out of France. It's actually, I saw it 3 days ago, and I knew it as the Cameroon variant, but it is now in France, and it's called the IHU variant. We don't know much about it. We just know there are 46 mutations in this virus and 12 gene deletions. And there's, I think, reading the paper, there seem to be two major mutations that affect the spike protein. So I don't think it's of great concern at this time, but it just illustrates the fact that there are always new variants popping up all over the world. And we hope that there will not be one that will push the Omicron variant out, because right now the Omicron variant seems to have little clinical danger for those who get it, except if you have comorbidities. And those we all know as lung disease, heart disease, diabetes, severe asthma, and immunosuppressive disorders, cancer therapy, et cetera. So I think the Omicron is currently about 95 to 98% of our infections in this country. The IHU variant has been seen in this country. I can't tell you where at this time, but it's the Cameroon variant, and we're just watching it.
And what would you say are the top mistakes that we make daily in abusing our immune system that we don't realize we're doing?
Oh, my gosh. We have so many things. We have lack of sleep is a big one. Working to the point where you're stressed out. If you work more than 12 hours a day, you should really cool it. Take a vacation. Take some time off. Make sure that you have a companion. You know, I talk about intimacy in the book, whether it's a lover or it's a partner or it's one of your children or your dog. It's important because neurohormonal changes occur when you have companionship and you socialize. That's all the more reason to make sure that you are not by yourself. If you are by yourself and you're a strong person, that's fine. But a lot of people are isolated now with this pandemic. I know people that are afraid to come out of their house. That is not a good thing for your host resistance, your immunity. If you've had a death in the family, a divorce, you're moving into a new house, you're taking an exam, all these things lower host resistance. We've known this for years and years and years, but it's all coming back to, you know, like I say, traditional medicine to try to understand the mind and how it controls the body and some say the soul as well. And in my case, the soul is the biological soul, and that's the immune system. The brain is the thing that really calls the shots. And the immune system affects behavior, as does diet. For example, I talk about the biomes in the book. I have a whole chapter on that. You've got to understand the complexity of immune function, and you've got to understand how to keep yourself healthy and to make your immune system the best thing, because that's you. That's your body. You're in charge. You're in control. The body, I call it a big metropolis. And in this metropolis, we have many, many different systems, and we want to make sure all of them are working in unison and to keep you living beyond 100 years of age. And that's really my goal here with this book. My book is to educate and make sure everybody gets vaccinated and takes care of themselves.
And that's just a sample of Dr. Bob Lahida's conversation, and we're going to get much deeper into the discussion over the latest variant and what it means for parents, the big debate over schools. You heard about Chicago and the school teachers there, teachers union keeping the kids out there in negotiations this weekend to try and get the teachers and the kids back into school. And we'll talk about that with Dr. Bob Lahida coming up in the 7 o'clock hour here on WMAL. We are at 6:30. a look at the news is in California, the difficulty finding coronavirus test kits in many parts of California and delays in getting results causing increasing frustration and helping drive the surge of infections in California. The number of people there hospitalized with COVID more than doubling. Delays in getting results or the inability to find a test kit, meaning that people with very mild or no symptoms may presume that they're not infected, going about their usual routines, but at the same time possibly infecting others. The governor of California, Gavin Newsom, said yesterday about 200 California National Guard members are being deployed to testing sites to boost capacity. Three men who chased and killed Ahmaud Arbery have been sentenced to life in prison, the judge denying any chance of parole for the father and son who armed themselves and initiated the deadly pursuit of the 25-year-old. Greg and Travis McMichael grabbed guns, chased Arbery in a pickup truck after spotting him running in their neighborhood outside of Brunswick, Georgia. Their neighbor, William Roddy Bryan, joined the pursuit, recorded cell phone video of Travis McMichael shooting Arbery with a shotgun. Bryan was granted a chance of parole, but must first serve at least 30 years in prison. Authorities say a Florida man with homemade explosive devices was arrested near a Tampa Bay area rally in support of a man jailed in connection with last year's riots at the Capitol. The Pinellas County Sheriff says 22-year-old Garrett Smith, arrested early Friday morning to mark the anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol. There was a rally Thursday night in St. Petersburg. It was held outside the county jail in support of that man being held on charges of participating in the riot. Sheriff says Smith was spotted across the street from the rally. He was initially detained on loitering charges, and then deputies reported finding a pipe bomb when they searched his backpack. And Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, one of former President Trump's most vocal supporters, has decided to seek re-election to a third term. Two Republicans with knowledge of his plans, but were not authorized to speak publicly about it, confirmed to the Associated Press on Friday that Ron Johnson plans to get in the race as soon as next week. Johnson had put off a decision on whether to run for months, saying there was no rush. But in recent weeks, he has indicated his announcement would be coming soon. 6:33, time for a check of the traffic and weather in LBD's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Maryland on Route 50, eastbound the John Hanson Highway at Lotsford Vista Road overpass, there is a crash. Three right lanes are blocked right now. In Maryland on the Beltway, inner loop and outer loop, there are no crashes and no construction being set up. You should be at the posted speed limit. And in Maryland, if you're traveling between the two beltways on 95, northbound and southbound lanes are clear. And 270 in Montgomery County, I have no reports of any delays between the beltway and Frederick, northbound and southbound. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Sunny skies and cold temperatures expected on this Saturday. Highs should reach the lower 30s across the region, but with the full sunshine, we will still expect a bit of melt. As we head overnight, partly cloudy, lows back into the 20s in the suburbs, lower 30s around town. For your Sunday, an area of low pressure and a cold front will move into the region, bringing with it some precipitation. Ahead of it, with the cold air, we will have the chance for some freezing rain. In fact, a winter weather advisory is in effect from 6 o'clock in the morning through noon, areas north and west of D.C. We will see temperatures moderate through the afternoon into the low and mid-40s, while have periods of rain continue through Sunday evening. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
21 degrees now in the nation's capital, 6:34 on the Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It's the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Good to have you with us. Jennifer Harper is with us each weekend, and she writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, keeps the pulse on the media, on the polls, what's going on. Jennifer, good morning.
Well, good morning to you.
So we've gotten through January 6th, but it will continue up to Election Day. We know that. And Jennifer, when we look at all of this, I think a lot of people are just kind of January 6th out. Do you have any poll numbers on that?
I have all sorts of things on that, and you're 100% right about this being a total bonanza for the press. I mean, yes, everybody's already sick of the attention, but yes, it will continue to election day, just as you say. And of course, there's a pretty interesting study that came from our friends over at newsbusters.org. That's a conservative press watchdog, if you don't know. Always a good read over there. And they referred to January 6th as the liberal media's Super Bowl. And I thought that was absolutely 100%. They tracked all of the coverage, particularly on the major broadcast networks. And they looked at the coverage on Good Morning America, on CBS Morning, NBC Today, et cetera, et cetera. And they spent 90 minutes, you know, obsessing over January 6th. And they said that this was the analysis. It said they spent 90 minutes dissecting, obsessing over, and painting 75 million plus Trump voters as enemies. This is according to Newsbusters, an interesting analysis. And the interest in this anniversary was so intense that the Politico, if you read Politico.com, they had to issue a whole guide to what the press was doing about it. And some of the headlines that came out of that was January 6th is all about Donald Trump. For those who love him, merely tolerate him, or crave his return to the White House, today is a media stunt. This is according to Politico. They say a contrived anniversary of an insignificant event boosted by Democrats in the press to punish Republicans and cynically advance Biden's legislative priorities. So that was what was going on. And as you mentioned before, and I think that's really significant, this whole thing is going to repeat and repeat, you know, rinse and repeat, et cetera. So I guess we just have to, I don't know, be patient or listen to something else.
While we're on the news media, obviously they have a huge influence over the White House. You picked up something from one of the analysts that I thought was very interesting.
Yes, I thought it was kind of interesting myself. And, you know, it made me remember that big phrase, liberal bias in the news media. And that phrase gets thrown around a lot. And I have a feeling that our listeners may not know how long that phrase has been around. I certainly didn't. But I found out that it first appeared in 1981, interest in liberal bias in the news media. And let's credit who was behind that. And that goes to political science scholars Robert Lichter. He's a gentleman who's a local here in D.C., and Stanley Rothman. And they did a landmark survey in 1981 to discover that 54% of journalists said that they were left of center, 29% were middle of the road, and only 17% were right of center. The year on that was 1981, and they later wrote a book called The Media Elite, America's New Power Brokers, and that was in 1986. Just to give you some historic background on all of this. And so now we've advanced all the way up here, and our good friend over at Fox News, Laura Ingraham, she came up with the idea that President Biden and his administration should really have a new name. And this is what she said. This isn't the Biden administration, is it really? It's the MSNBC administration. And that was her commentary on this. And, of course, saying that the liberal media is still holds sway over the White House. And she's convinced that the administration's left-leaning and progressive policies are simply not a good fit for the average American. She says the U.S. is not that liberal. And I thought that's pretty good observation. She said this isn't a hard left country. They're not going to be able to convince voters to dump the Electoral College, make Washington, D.C. a state, get rid of capitalism, or eliminate prisons. It's not going to happen. This is what she is predicting, even if we do have an MSNBC administration. So interesting words and pretty good observation on the part of our friend Laura.
So former President Trump has certainly gotten a lot of attention over the past week. Where is he this weekend?
Yeah, let's talk about that. And this is certainly an indication that Mr. Trump is still got a very active playbook and is still very much on his game. Because if you did not know, he has a big fat Save America rally taking place tonight in Florence, Arizona. And again, he's still calling him a Save America rally, just as he did when he was on the campaign trail. This kind of strategy worked for him way back when he was running for president and could work for him again. We'll have to see. But anyway, it's kind of got all the hallmarks of a very classic Trump rally from those campaign days. And this is what the organizers told me. Anyway, the event will open. This is certainly according to Arizona time, the doors open at 8 a.m. and then the live entertainment begins at 2 p.m. Then they have pre-programmed speakers at 5 p.m. and Mr. Trump finally steps on the stage at 7 p.m. and he's going to deliver remarks. But all that aside, that follows the same template as all the other rallies that he ever did, which just gave a whole day-long experience for those who really care for him and his policies. So I thought it was interesting that he's kind of stepped back up to the plate.
So the Trump tailgate party starts at 8 a.m. Mountain Time. You know, a lot of the former White House staffers have been coming out with books and making comments, and they're pundits now. You have one of them that stood out this week with some strong advice for the GOP.
Yeah, this is pretty good. This is Steve Cortez. He was a senior advisor to former President Mr. Trump, and he has some advice for Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy. He says, taking nominal control of Capitol Hill will not be enough. He's predicting, you know, if they manage to win over the majority in November. But anyway, he's wondering, Rick, if Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy and all the rest of those folks are just going to be satisfied with stopping all the socialist-inspired agenda, progressives and things like that that we already know about. And here's what he has to say. Again, this is Steve Cortez. He says, will they boldly implement a full-throttle, populist, nationalist, America First agenda? He says doing so requires focus, not a scattershot approach. The next Republican majority Congress must concentrate intensely on a short list of the most pressing issues where only the populace can rescue everyday Americans from the abuses of oligarchs and their handmaidens in both political parties. And he wrote this in an analysis for Real Clear Politics. Anyway, he says, healing the economy is not enough. Our society suffers a sickness of the soul as well, and legions of everyday Americans feel silenced and intimidated by ruling class elites who insist that we pretend to believe fundamental myths like the existence of dozens of genders. It's high time for politicians to speak publicly the way the vast majority of Americans speak regarding the hot-button cultural issues. He says, right now, powerful forces collude to oppress the masses via financial and cultural repression. Only the emerging populist nationalist movement can protect citizens in both realms. Restoring wages and restoring gender sanity represent an agenda worthy of a great movement in the new year. Again, that's Steve Cortez writing in RealClearPolitics.com.
Well, the borders are Vice President Harris ignoring the border, the media ignoring the border, the Democrats ignoring the border, but you are not ignoring the border.
No, I never do. And, you know, I lived in Texas for a little while, and it's a great area of the United States, but there was a close eye put on Douglas Nichols this week. He is the mayor of Yuma, Arizona. And encounters with illegal immigrants have surged 2,405% on Yuma so far in the fiscal year. This is according to numbers from the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol. And the mayor has now declared a state of emergency in that area. He seems to be longing for the olden days when President Trump was in office. And anyway, here's some of the numbers here. In the months of October and November 2020, there were 1,777 encounters with illegal immigrants in Yuma. And during the months of October and November in 2021, 1 year later, the number was 44,512. Mr. Nichols went on Fox News to talk about that, and he also pointed some numbers from the local newspaper down there, the Yuma Sun. He discovered that the Yuma Sun said that 20 to 25 immigrants arrive at the Yuma Regional Medical Center emergency room every single day. And that number includes 4 to 5 maternity patients. So this is a city of 93,000 folks. So it's a city, but it's not that big. Anyway, he is wondering, the mayor is wondering now, if they have the resources to deal with it all. He says local leaders along the U.S.-Mexico border agree that President Biden's border policies aren't working. Instead of fixing the crisis, Biden is doubling down and leaving border cities to fend for themselves. This is according to Torrance Sinclair. He's the spokesman for the National Republican Congressional Committee. So things are still tough down there for everybody, you know, whether they're on the welcoming end of the committee there or whether the folks who are seeking to get across the border, tough all around.
Well, we got past January 6th and we got past New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, but still there are words that linger that we would just as soon not see lingering anymore in 2022. You got a list for us.
Oh, yes, this is great. This is the banished words list. And this is coming from Lake Superior State University. It's kind of a tongue-in-cheek designation of all these words and phrases, which they say are overworked, redundant, oxymoronic, cliched, illogical, nonsensical, and otherwise ineffective, baffling, or irritating. So these are these phrases that you're really tired of. So let's get right to them, because you hear a lot of our press relations folks, including those at the White House, using these kind of phrases. And the very number one winner and the top offender was the phrase, "Wait, what? Wait, what?" I have to repeat that for you. It's followed by "no worries," followed by "at the end of the day." "That being said," that was in fourth place, followed by "asking for a friend," "circle back," "deep dive," "the new normal," "you're on mute," and last but not least, "supply chain." Everybody is sick of this, and these were nominations that came to the university. They got 1,250 nominations for banished words and phrases that came not only from the United States, but also from Norway, Belgium, England, Scotland, Australia, and Canada. They say most people speak through informal discourse. Most people shouldn't misspeak through informal discourse. That's the distinction nominators far and wide made, and our judges agreed with them. Again, this is coming from Lake Superior State University, and a lot of folks pointed out to me that certainly the White House press office say they're circling back a lot. So that's on the banished word list.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, as always, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Rick. Have a good day, everybody.
Jim Trusty's next, right after traffic and weather. Here's LBD on WMAL.
Good morning. In Virginia, right now on the Beltway, no delays on the inner loop or on the outer loop. You can set your cruise control if you got it. On 66 in Fairfax County, no construction and no crashes, either on the eastbound side or on the westbound side. On 95 in Virginia, between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, you're not going to hit your brakes. Lanes are clear, northbound and southbound. And in the district, on 295, 395, and 695, all lanes clear and at speed. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Sunny skies and cold temperatures expected on this Saturday. Highs should reach the lower 30s. As we head overnight, partly cloudy, lows back into the 20s in the suburbs, lower 30s around town. For your Sunday, an area of low pressure with the cold air, we will have the chance for some freezing rain. In fact, a winter weather advisory is in effect from 6 o'clock in the morning through noon, areas north and west of D.C. We will see temperatures moderate through the afternoon into the low and mid-40s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
21 degrees in the nation's capital, 648 on WMAL. It's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler, and we saw so much attention this week to January 6th, the first anniversary of the riots at Capitol Hill. And we saw the response of the administration and the Justice Department. And who better than to analyze it all for us than the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice, Jim Trusty. He is now a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. Jim, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Rick. Good morning.
Well, a lot of things to look at here. You've got the Department of Justice, you've got the prosecutions, you've got the threat, I guess, that if we haven't gotten you yet, we're still going to get you. The Attorney General, Merrick Garland, making comments this week, and I would think from your perspective as to having been at such a high level in DOJ, you would have some thoughts on that.
I definitely have some thoughts about it, and I read through the speech very carefully, and look, there's good swaths of the speech that are kind of uncontroversial statements of patriotism or love of rule of law. But I think there's some real problems with what he had to say, too. And, you know, he went very quickly from thanking DOJ employees and talking about how hard the pandemic is. He went heavy into January 6th and talked about the Capitol riots and said that those involved must be held accountable and there's no higher priority for us at the DOJ. Again, I think it's an open question whether the riots should be considered the highest priority of DOJ. But they've certainly drawn a lot of resources. He talked about how they've arrested more than 725 defendants, how they've had 140 prosecutors handling these cases. And, again, what struck me from that kind of commentary is that it's this body count approach. Like, look at us. We've already prosecuted 725, and we're going to go for more. I don't think the body count approach to prosecution is necessarily a very good sign. And the thought of 140 prosecutors being involved in this case tells you this is not an insignificant resource drain for what are mostly been misdemeanors and, again, some assaults on police officers. And let me just bookmark one thing, Rick, with you, if that's okay. You know, if somebody assaults a police officer, I could care less with their political stripes. I think if they're going after police, they need to be vigorously prosecuted. And that goes for whether they're Antifa, BLM, you know, January 6th defendants or anybody in between. It should be a pretty even-handed approach.
Jim, the attorney general in his remarks said, quote, "The central norm is that in our criminal investigations, there cannot be different rules depending on one's political party or affiliation. But it seems as though there have been some very extreme punishments, including solitary confinement, for some of those charged and not necessarily those charged with assaulting police officers."
Yeah, I think that really gets to the heart of why a lot of conservatives struggle with how they feel about January 6th and about the characterizations that are out there in the mainstream media and about these extremely aggressive prosecutions. I mean, again, we can start with a basic bottom line that assaulting police isn't justified and that deserves prosecution. But when I talk to people about January 6th, they immediately look at the difference in prosecutorial behavior when it comes to things that happened in D.C. and Portland and Seattle. It's very hard for anyone to stomach differential treatment within the criminal justice system. And the attorney general can make this comment about, you know, we don't want to have different rules based on your political party, but we've sure seen that play out. I mean, the amount of cases in Portland that were dismissed after people literally assaulted police and destroyed businesses was extraordinary. I think at last count, it was something like 700 out of 900 cases. And we recently had an example of this where a gentleman was sentenced in Portland for throwing a Molotov cocktail at a police officer. I mean, think of the significance of that moment. He literally wanted to have a police officer burst into flames. Luckily, the cocktail didn't explode the right way. It didn't burn the officer. That guy got about 4 years in prison for that behavior. And if you compare that to Buffalo Hat Man from the Capitol riots, Jacob Chansley, I believe his name was, he got 41 months for essentially walking around the Senate in a bad outfit. To think about how similar those bottom line sentences are for such extremely different conduct. And so I think that eats at a lot of us, again, not to defend people that assault police, but to see this massive mobilization of DOJ resources where many of the charges are glorified trespassing charges, it makes you wonder about the even-handedness of our criminal justice system.
Well, Jim, the January 6th rioters weren't the only people mentioned in the attorney general's remarks. Don't recall him saying anything about the Chicago gang violence that topped homicide records for last year, but who did he hone in on?
Yeah, not a word about any gang violence or innocent victims in Chicago, New York, or elsewhere. But he actually spent some time talking about how we are besieged by violent threats and assaults, and specifically included school personnel, as he called it, and election workers in that category. And to me, it's like, once again, this attorney general apparently just reads like the New York Times headlines and doesn't actually back up anything with data. I mean, essentially, we're back to the Virginia school boards. It's completely overstated to act like our school personnel are besieged with threats. And it's a complete violation of any basic principle of federalism for the attorney general to kind of assume the mantle of defending every single person in every state against threatening conduct. So, again, if you follow the Department of Justice, you recognize that, you know, attorney generals bring different politics into play, and it doesn't always really change the aircraft carrier's direction a whole lot. But everything we're hearing from this attorney general is overstated, politicized, and anti-federal.
Well, Jim, that aircraft carrier you just mentioned seems to be headed to Georgia, even though all three defendants in the Ahmaud Arbery case were found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. The feds are still going after charges?
Yeah, it looks that way. You know, we talked about this before, about how typically federal civil rights prosecutions that were operating in tandem with some sort of state prosecution were only going to be pursued when there was some sort of injustice, when there's an unvindicated federal interest. And we talked about the L.A. police getting acquittals in state court and being prosecuted successfully federally. Well, here, the Vic Michaels father and son just got life without parole. Roddy Bryant got a life sentence where he'd have to serve at least till he's in his 80s before he could be released. And somehow this federal indictment is supposed to go to trial a month from today, and it will be, again, completely duplicative of what's already happened. The other kind of moment of craziness in all this is there's a report out that Arbery's mother announced that the feds wanted to give this 30-year consecutive plea and that she had rejected the plea. Well, this is kind of crazy on a couple of fronts. The first being, you know, again, why is there even a need for a federal prosecution under the standards of prosecution that DOJ has followed for many years? There doesn't seem to be any sort of unvindicated interest here or need for additional time. But secondly, Mrs. Arbery, with all due respect for her loss, is not a plaintiff. I mean, that's not how the system works, where the victims call the shots on what happens with disposing of cases by way of plea agreements. So everything about this, if it's accurately reported, it's another situation where the Civil Rights Division of DOJ is completely running amok and creating horrible precedent while tearing down any last notions of federalism.
Here's one at the Supreme Court that will be fascinating to see how this one plays out. The arguments on COVID mandates. From what you've heard so far of the Supreme Court, any sense of where this may head?
Yeah, always hard to tell. It's difficult to play the odds with Supreme Court justices because they're very good at essentially pretending to have a different position than they really have. You can't always judge by their questions. They had before them essentially two emergency proceedings. One, the Labor Department or the OSHA dictate that employers with 100 or more employees have to either mandate vaccines or masks and weekly tests. And the other is tied to healthcare facilities that receive federal aid and the workers there. So the first one, I think, is dead unconstitutional. I think that it's very likely the Supreme Court is going to say what many prominent Democrats said about a year ago, that a federal mandate requiring vaccines or masks and weekly tests in the workplace is unconstitutional. It's just not part of the federal powers. I think the headlines that are going to come out of this from yesterday, though, are all about Sotomayor. Justice Sotomayor said some things out of complete left field, and they're just clearly not accurate. She said Omicron is as deadly to the unvaccinated as the Delta variant. And she went on to say we have over 100,000 children in serious condition and many on ventilators. Now, first of all, it's really not for the Supreme Court justices to start creating facts anyway. They're supposed to be reviewing a record or reviewing affidavits that are submitted in support of a position. But she opined about some things that are just clearly not accurate. And it's kind of disturbing that a Supreme Court justice would be so strident in putting out incorrect information. And it struck me that the liberal wing of the bench, at least, seems very interested in pumping up the necessity of these steps, even making comments. I think Justice Kagan's made comments about how important it is to get vaccinated. What I thought I heard that was maybe a little more up my alley was Amy Coney Barrett asking, when does the emergency end? And to me, that's a great question, you know, for any sort of governmental overreach, because they always start with an emergency, but then they never seem to recede. And I think that's where Justice Barrett was going. But I think Justice Gorsuch in particular felt very strongly that, you know, no matter what the nature of the problem is with COVID, that it's not up to this administration's executive branch to just promulgate rules and make us all fall into line. So I think the main mandate about OSHA is pretty well doomed. The second one that's on the table is a little closer call just because the feds have more control over the federal workplace. So if you have federal employees, or in this case, folks working within healthcare facilities that get Medicare or Medicaid dollars, it's not quite as constitutionally offensive to put some strings on those dollars. But either way, whether they rule the same way on both or if they split the baby in terms of that second one, I think we're going to know something within about a week or so, and it'll be very interesting.
So if Justice Sotomayor put out misinformation on vaccines and COVID, could she be banned from Twitter?
Well, Rick, anyone can be banned from Twitter any day of the week. So I don't hold my breath that they will ban somebody from the left side of the political aisle. But she certainly put out the misinformation yesterday in the court setting.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, always appreciate you getting into the details on all of this stuff, because for the layman, it's pretty tough to follow sometimes. Jim, thank you.
Sure. It's tough for the lawyers, too, but thanks.
7 o'clock news next with Heather Curtis on WMAL.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. The one radio station for you to depend on. All day, every day. 105.9 FM, WMAL, a Cumulus Media station.